Talking river monsters with host Jeremy Wade. You can catch it on Animal Planet. First couple of seasons out on DVD, and his book came out just a month or so ago, and definitely worth catching up on this show. Highly enjoyable. And speaking of catching up, thank you, UFO Ghost, Kevin, John, Punk God, Wiener Dog, Zen BBQ, and Rev K, some of the people that got me over 500 on the Twitter feed. So thank you, followers, and I hope to make it worth your while with regular updates on what's coming up on Coast to Coast as it develops during the week, plus some observations about things in the news and some personal stuff I'll throw in there from time to time. But nice to have you. Thank you. And thank you to those of you that joined in the conversation a couple of weeks ago when I was hosting the Tuesday night chat on Coast Insider. I've seen a couple others since then that have made contact from that. Really enjoyed that conversation. Just another great feature for Coast Insider. You can find out more about that if you go to coasttocoastam.com. Some great news stories up there, and one crypto news story we'll get back to. But we were just talking about the Amazon Nessie story, and we got to find out, well, then what is it? If you've looked at the photos at coasttocoastam.com of Jeremy Wade and his river monsters, after he took the photo, after he found this photo in his reel of shots that he took when he was in the Amazon, what was it? What's the prevailing wisdom of the creature that he caught, in this case, on film? Next, on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Okay, so again, we're talking with Jeremy Wade and the star of River Monsters. So you took these photos that you took of the Amazonian Nessie, and you showed them to biologists. You showed them to scientists in England. What did they ever determine it was?
Well, it was inconclusive to start with. People were thinking it might be some completely new type of animal. What it turned out to be in the end, now, I think what I should say here is anybody who's reading my book or who might read it should maybe plug their ears for a minute, because I sort of trail it at the beginning and then I reveal at the end. But in the end, it was a fairly, well, I think, although I'm not certain, a fairly mundane explanation. One thing that was suggested was that it was an Amazon pink dolphin that had been run over by a boat, and the outboard motor, you know, propeller, had actually had scarred its back. Now, the only problem with that was, in this part of the Amazon at that time, nobody had boats with motors. It couldn't have been that. But then a fisherman told me something which I think is the likely explanation. And what that is, I mean, it's actually quite sad. In a way, I'd rather not know this. But we have a certain idea about dolphins in the West. You know, they're intelligent, cuddly animals. But if you're an Amazon fisherman, they tend to have a fairly sort of adversarial relationship with dolphins. Dolphins will steal fish from their nets. Sometimes they will get caught in the nets themselves. It doesn't happen very often because they've got this echolocation ability. They can see even in muddy water. They can navigate really carefully. They don't normally get caught in nets. But if they do, they're going to destroy the fisherman's net, and that's going to that's a severe financial blow to them. And what I was told by a fisherman is that this was possibly a pink dolphin that was caught in a net by a fisherman that was maybe still alive rather than, you know, had drowned when he pulled the net in. And then, you know, as a bit of a sort of a sick joke in a way, this fisherman would have mutilated the dolphin with a machete and actually cut this shape into its back. And then, because dolphins are actually very hardy creatures, it survived. And so there's the hand of man in there somewhere, and we're talking now probably about 30 or 40 years ago that this might have happened. I don't have absolute confirmation that this is what happened, but that's the most likely explanation I have. As I say, it's a slightly disappointing explanation. But then, as I said before, the more significant thing out of this story for me is that here's something that I saw. Nobody believed me until I actually produced the evidence. But if it hadn't been for that, I would have completely sort of erased it from my mind and would have stayed of this sort of opinion that you have to have evidence, otherwise something doesn't exist.
Well, I encourage people to go if they can't now because they're working at some point later on this week and search for this at the coasttocoastam.com website and look at that photo of the Amazonian Nessie. I would give it, I mean, you're an expert. I'm sure the person you spoke with is an expert, but just looking at that photo and seeing the length of it and seeing how, I would give that explanation about a 30% chance of being right. I mean, maybe it's the best explanation out there, but that doesn't seem to be a slam dunk.
If anybody's got a better explanation, I'm sort of welcome to hear that. I mean, that by what I've just said, by no means is the last word. That is the best explanation I've had so far.
Well,
unfortunately, you know, what would really settle it would be to actually capture the animal if it's still alive,
sure.
and have a real close look at it. But this is something that appeared out of the water for a fraction of a second, and you know, it's too blurred for the human eye to make any sense of. And that photograph, you can only see a certain amount. I did video it as well, but it's literally three frames on the videotape.
How about that?
Each frame, you know, 27th of a second or something.
Right.
So, yes, it would be good to. It would be interesting to examine the creature. That would settle it, I think. But the chances of that are very small.
But unlike a lot of other creatures that live in the water, if it's a pink dolphin, it's coming up for air. And if it's coming up for air, it's bound to have been seen many, many, many more times, I would think. I mean, with the amount of fishing traffic, I mean, if that's a mutilated dolphin, it can't just be at the bottom of the river. It's got to come up a lot.
It does.
The thing is,
this is a very sparsely populated part of the Amazon, and after photographing it, I actually went back to try and film it, and it took me 6 weeks to find this thing. Filming it was actually very lucky when I got it. And at the same time, I was talking to anybody that I met, and in the time that I was there, I found only another two or three people who've seen it. And that's allowing for, you know, the people who do fish on the lake, who are there sort of scanning the water surface. It is something that's quite secretive. They although they do come up to breathe, they can do it in quite a
surreptitious manner.
An unobtrusive way.
Again, go look at the photos at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking with Jeremy Wade of River Monsters. So then on to the canoe. You mentioned the canoes a couple of times. That's like one of those things. I'm watching the show and I'm like, get out of a canoe. You're going after monsters. What are you doing in a canoe? I mean, you are a very confident man in these skinny little boats going around.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of these waters, they're too big. You can't really access the water from the bank. And then if you want to get on the water, you've just got to go with what the local people use. And these Amazon fishing canoes, I mean, the Amerindians who live there tend to be smaller than Europeans and North Americans. And you know, I've got in some of these things, and you're literally, you know, you've got about an inch or so of freeboard around the edge. If you put your hand on the edge of the canoe, your fingertips are actually in the water. If you wobble it too much, water comes in. If the wind gets up, water comes in. And that particular lake where I saw the Amazon Nessie, it's a big lake, it's a deep lake. The wind can come from nowhere, storms can come from nowhere. And I've been very nervous out in the middle of the lake there. And then you have this sort of strange element also of the supernatural creeping in. That particular lake, fishermen have told me that that sometimes they are held out in the middle as if it's by some strange power. You're paddling, but you're getting no closer to the side. And I've actually had that feeling myself a few times. And I think it's because you're so far from any points of reference, it can really feel like you're getting nowhere. And maybe there's ripples on the surface which are moving in one direction. And you know, your mind does start to play tricks when you're a little bit afraid. So yeah, I agree with you about canoes, but it gives everything, you know, all your experiences have a certain higher intensity if you're in a precarious position. I've had dolphins erupt in the water right underneath me, and when that happens with no warning, suddenly there's an explosion of water right underneath where you're sitting, or there's a line of bubbles coming in, sort of, you know, intersecting the boat, things like that. It's very intense for sure.
You know, how does a vicar's son process that supernatural like experience that you're having, say, in the middle of a lake when it feels almost like an invisible hand is controlling your destiny?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, my father, although he was a Church of England priest, but he sort of just had this general view, which I share, which is, you know religion is an attempt to explain things that we don't understand, and it explains things in terms that we can best understand them. And I would sum up my general view in the same way. And we're not even necessarily talking about the supernatural. Even the natural world, there's so much there that we don't know about that is almost or definitely beyond our powers of understanding. So yes, there are. I have this scientific background as well, which at one extreme can be a bit sort of fundamentalist. You know, science, some science has almost lost its sense of wonder. But
sure.
I think there's a lot below the surface, both of the water and of other aspects of life that we don't have much idea about. But we can sort of get inklings of that from time to time. And sometimes that is to do with your perception and trying to sort of open, not being so rigid about your perception, trying to, you know, being open to things that aren't in your everyday life.
What are you still pursuing? What is still on your list of fishes that you either have been told exist, you've seen glimpses of, but haven't caught? Who's in the most wanted list of Jeremy Wade?
Well, we've sort of done the most obvious stories, the big toothy fish that can bite bits of your leg off or pull you under. We've done those, and I'm now in the middle of filming season four, and I'm quite surprised that we're here. We're getting into more quirky territory. There's still a few stories out there. I don't want to say too much about what I'm filming at the moment, but. Like any fisherman, I'm afraid I do have this obsession with size, and there are certain fish which I've caught that I'd really like to go back and catch a bigger one. And unfortunately, when we're filming, we tend to need just one fish which is big enough for the film, one fish that will make people sort of gasp and think, gosh, that's,
right.
I never knew anything like that existed. Whereas I know, for instance, the Goliath tiger fish, I caught this Goliath tiger fish that's about 80 pounds, and by the time I caught that, I'd worked out how to catch these things. It had taken me a couple of weeks. I now knew what to do. And my crew is then forcibly restraining me from doing any more fishing. You know, we've got the fish. We don't need a bigger one. You know, we've now got, witch doctors to interview and all this kind of stuff. So although it's great from my point of view to go to these places that I wouldn't go to so much, my instinct to just keep fishing and try and catch a bigger one, I can't do when we're filming. And so that's something that there are possibly revisit in the future. A bigger arapaima, a bigger alligator gar. Some of these things do grow to incredible sizes. And one thing I haven't said so far is that, the idea of fish and size, again, fishermen's tales, we tend to disbelieve them. But there is a reason why fish can grow can throw up occasional freak individuals, and it's all to do with the fact that they live in water. An animal that lives on land, if it starts getting too big, gravity kicks in, it can't move around, and if it can't move around, it can't feed. So if you look at sort of horses or something, all horses grow to the same maximum size. You don't get any horse that's twice as tall as all the other horses, for example. Underwater, however, the body is supported by water. We talk about a fish that weighs 500 pounds. Most fish actually weigh nothing in water. So that fish can just keep growing and growing and growing. The goonch that we talked about earlier on, the giant devil catfish, they just sit there on the bottom of the river and they let the current carry food to them. And they can just grow. If there's enough food, they will just keep on growing. So there is a sound biological reason why some of these stories about big fish can be true. We can't rule them out for biological reasons. So that's my thing, really. Go back and get some bigger ones of some of these creatures.
You mentioned the alligator gar then of Texas. And what other river monsters would you be looking for in the United States? What should we be looking for, those of us that want to catch one of our own?
There are some interesting creatures. I'm not a great expert in the U.S. species, although I have been back doing a bit more filming this last year. There are some big catfish. There are two large catfish species, the blue catfish and the flathead catfish. You mentioned the Mississippi earlier on. You know, that there are, I believe, blue catfish in excess of 100 pounds. Flatheads probably, you know, similar kind of size. I've heard lots of stories. Lots of people email me about it, and many stories of big catfish near dams. And the one story which keeps surfacing in various different guises is about divers going down to do maintenance work and coming shooting out of the water and saying, "I'm never getting in there again because there's these huge catfish down there." And so I was looking into that this year. To see, you know, what degree of reality there might be in that. As part of that, this is sort of already known by some people, so I can mention this. I was trying a bit of catfish noodling. Now that's interesting. Sort of going first into an underwater hole, and you're expecting something the size of a large dog to bite you. That was a new experience for me, and I'm not sure that I'd recommend other people sort of do that unless they're under sort of very good instruction. But
noodling is that very interesting thing where you literally are catching, you're almost using your arm as bait, and then as soon as they bite on your arm, then you pull them out of the hole.
That's absolutely right. And the thing is, they're doing that to their nesting. They're doing that to defend their nest. And now that I've experienced that, you know, that is absolutely clear demonstration that fish will attack people. They don't necessarily know that it's a person, but there's something coming in there. And even though it's pitch black, which is quite amazing, they can, you know, they will very precisely clamp down on your hand or your arm or your foot or whatever happens to be in there. I was investigating a story a couple of years ago about some swimmers in a lake on the edges of Berlin, and they were being bitten by something in the water, and this looked like it was the European Wells catfish. And a lot of people were thinking, well, no, this is ridiculous. You know, what fish is possibly going to do that? But the example of what happens in the US with these mainly flathead catfish biting people who stick their hands and feet too close to them, you know, absolutely demonstrates that fish do go for people in certain circumstances.
We're going to come up on a break here in just a minute, and so I know we won't get the whole thing in, but I do want to ask you about that bull shark experience, because if we're talking about river monsters, I think one thing that a lot of people could accept pretty easily in the United States is that there are a lot more sharks swimming in brackish to fresh water than we would probably know about. And we might be surprised how far up into fresh water these sharks can actually swim. So I want you to address that coming up in just a minute. And I want you to tell the story then of that 9-foot, 500-pound bull shark that you pulled in fresh water. That's the theme of the show River Monsters. It's all the fish that you wouldn't expect to be lurking in fresh water down in the mud, in the silt, frequently in that very, you know, in that water that's hard to see into, something is seeing back at us. And we'll talk more about that coming up on Coast to Coast. And then we'll get to your questions and your comments for Jeremy Wade on the way at the top of the hour. So about 30 minutes from now, you can jump in if you know of a place where there is a river monster lurking that he needs to know about. We'll get to that coming up. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We'll get back to Jeremy Wade. We'll talk about sharks, how far up into fresh water sharks are swimming, and you probably didn't even know about it. And then about the story about him catching this 9-foot-long bull shark, where and how, especially when he's in these little rickety, canoes. Coming up tomorrow on Coast to Coast, 1950s ufology. 1950s ufology coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. Back to Jeremy Wade, and we'll get to your calls eventually on the way. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. Jeremy Wade is out with a book and also the first couple of seasons of River Monsters as well, and looking forward to the one that's coming up on Animal Planet, the biggest show that they have on Animal Planet, River Monsters, and for good reason. So let's talk about these freshwater sharks, as it were, or at least sharks that can adapt to fresh water. How far up into rivers do sharks ordinarily swim? How long do they stay there? And shouldn't we be more worried about that here in the U.S., where a lot of our rivers meet up with oceans?
Well, it's mainly one species of shark we're talking about, which is bull sharks, which have this ability to survive in fresh water. Most sea fish can't survive in fresh water, but bull sharks are able to. And what this means is that it's actually, you know, it's not great whites. It's actually bull sharks, which are potentially most dangerous to people because they can come into water, which is also frequented by people. But one thing I should emphasize there is that it is the word potential. The number of incidents is very small. And as with a lot of things, if you know what the risks are, you can avoid them. There are certain quite simple rules there. In terms of how far they come up rivers, they've been recorded. In the Amazon, a couple of thousand miles up. I mean, you know, they can come a long, long, you know, way up into fresh water. They've been recorded in the Mississippi above St. Louis. I'm just actually flicking through my book. I'm trying to find the exact details.
Wow! Above St. Louis?
Let me see.
That's a long way. That's a long way from the Mississippi Delta.
I'm just thinking. Alton, Illinois, I think it is.
That's north of St. Louis.
There's lots of dams now, so, you know, blocking the way. But potentially they can come, as long as the water is warm, they can come, you know, a long way up into fresh water.
Wow.
But the interesting thing is, I've now done quite a bit of research into bull sharks in fresh water, and a couple of years ago in South Africa, I caught two very large male bull sharks, I mean, among the biggest male sharks, ever recorded, but close to 10 foot long, around 500 pounds, probably a little bit over 500 pounds in weight. And we tagged these. I was working with some scientists. We put acoustic tags on them, which means that although you can't see into the water and you don't see the fin cutting the surface, anything like that, you can sit in a boat with a hydrophone, and this is something that sort of picks up. Is able to, you know, tell what direction and how far away the fish is. And we were following these fish, and they were swimming to within feet of people who were standing in the water. People were standing up to their waist in water, either fly fishing or maybe they're collecting prawns out of the bottom mud. And the popular view about bull sharks, though they don't have very good vision, the popular view is that they will just go up and chew anything that is in their way on the off chance that it might be edible. What was interesting about these fish is that they would approach people to within a few feet, a few yards, and then veer off. They weren't interested, which completely goes against everybody's perception of bull sharks. It actually shows them to be very discriminating normally, and you know, not necessarily these sort of, you know, blindly murderous man-eating beasts.
No, but it does go to the point that you could be standing in water, in murky water, and not know there was a bull shark nearby.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, that's a little terrifying to the average, you know, river wader.
In a sense, you know, what you don't know, you don't worry about. And so these people were quite oblivious that these, you know, 10-foot-long animals were coming out and then passing on. But, you know, normally the fish, you know, you'll go your way, the fish will go its way, and, you know, nobody, you know, you both come away from that situation safely. But there are people occasionally who do fall foul of bull sharks. I mean, not very many, but when it does hit the news, because, you know, as far as most people are concerned, that is pretty horrific. But there are again, one of the themes that I try and get across in the program is that, yes, it is about fear, and in a sense the program plays on fear. You get people's attention by that. But then what you're trying to do is, well, you know, there's different ways you can approach fear. One is to want to try and exterminate the thing that you're afraid of, and that doesn't work, and that can even actually make things worse. The other thing you can do is understand what it is and, you know, what motive has it for, you know, if it does attack people. And bull sharks, you know, there are certain fairly sort of basic rules. And, you know, one is to know if your particular river is frequented by bull sharks. You know, it's not very many rivers that are. And then if that is the case, then don't swim. Don't go swimming at sort of early morning, late evening. Don't go swimming after rain, which is when the water can be particularly cloudy and food items can be sort of washed in. So it's not necessarily a case of, you know, don't go in the water, it's not safe to get back in the water, but it's adapting our behaviour. And then if you do that, it's possible to coexist with some of these potentially dangerous animals.
I was surprised, though. I was watching River Monsters, I believe it was, and you by hand caught a rather large ray.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in shallow water, yes?
Yes, rays can be in very shallow water. They typically hang out, or some species particularly hang out in very shallow water.
But didn't you pull this one, like, right out of the mud?
Well, that was one. Let me see. The last season that we had a very big, big ray from Argentina, which took nearly 4 hours to. The thing is, stingrays they can stick themselves to the bottom of the river, so it's like trying to pull the plug out of the river. So eventually, I got this thing into the shallows, and then went along to have a close look at it. But I was wearing chainmail gloves at the time, gloves anyway.
Still, but how big was that ray that you pulled out of the river by hand?
Let me see. I never weighed it, but I got a good measurement, and based on what I've seen before, I think that it was. Let me see.
I want to say it was like 6 feet wide. It was huge.
It was getting on for 6 feet. It was more like it was about sort of getting on for 5 feet wide, but it would have been about 275 pounds.
Okay, 275 pounds, 5 feet wide, and it's a ray, and it's in the shallows of a water. And this is why I remember looking at it going, if anybody would have stepped in onto its back, if anybody would have just stepped in in the river and stepped on it, it would have been me. That's my first thought was, if there is one in a river somewhere, I'm going to be the one to find it. But it was a fresh water. I mean, like a lot of rays, right, are fresh water.
Well, exactly. Again, you know, as far as most people are concerned, stingrays only live in the ocean. But there are certain species in certain parts of the world that live in the rivers. And for instance, in the Amazon, you know, you go further north from where I caught that one, you go into Brazil, people fear them more than they do piranhas. But again, it's a defensive reaction. They'll only stab you if you tread on them. And again, there are places where I wouldn't sort of go wading in the water for any money. But there's a general rule which can minimise your risk of being stabbed by a stingray, and that is if you're wading in shallow water, instead of lifting your feet and putting them down like you would normally, if you shuffle forward, so you keep your foot in contact with the mud, you shuffle forward. If there's a stingray there, you will nudge the edge of its body, and it will then ripple away. If you, on the other hand, tread in the middle of its back, it will stab you. Generally speaking, there you're talking severe pain. People tell me it's like putting your foot in a fire. Very, very bad pain, which lasts at least 24 hours. The wound can get infected. I spoke to somebody in Argentina. The wound was weeping and infected for 6 or 7 years, he said. It can turn into gangrene if you don't treat it. You know, it's pretty nasty. But normally we're talking pain. Although if you're really unlucky, if that spine, which can be several inches long, if that were to pierce a major blood vessel, if there was a child sort of rolling around in the river or whatever, then you know, that could be a fatal wound.
Well, I mean, look at Steve Irwin. I mean, there was the crocodile hunter killed by that spine on a ray, And it wasn't, the ray wasn't even attacking him.
Well, the thing is that that is a very, as I said, it is potentially a lethal weapon. The stingray spine is like a serrated dagger.
Yeah.
Very, very sharp. But normally, yes, it is deployed just defensively, or it is a freak occurrence.
Well, it's the kind of thing that, like, again, you see a ray that big, and you pull it up 200 plus pounds. You pull it up out of the shallows of a river, and I'm thinking, I was really kind of freaking out about it. I was watching it because of Steve Irwin, who took that. Mm. All it took was that one thing to go, and it just by fluke went right into his heart, and he was dead almost instantly, and that's a big thing to be lurking in fresh water and not really know about. Although, as you said, the people in the Amazon where they were. They fear those more than piranha. And piranha has come up a bunch of times on your show as you've talked about them, because that is, I think, something that we fear. And we don't have any piranha in the U.S., right? None of them are creeping up American rivers.
Well, I've heard rumors that they might be in Florida, but Florida being sort of semi-tropical, very warm water, there is a case that occasionally people who keep fish in tanks and they get too much of a handful, they will find their way into a local lake or river. Normally, those fish won't survive. In warm water, they might for a while. Normally, they won't breed. You'll just get the odd stray individual turning up. I've heard of African lungfish and all sorts turning up. But no, I don't think they're
okay.
There or in any numbers, but the thing that piranhas are very interesting because again, this is a fish that is surrounded by a lot of myth, and how do you actually separate what is true from what is not true? And the truth is actually very complex. There, the truth is different depending on the circumstances. Piranha certainly have the potential to be very dangerous, and in certain circumstances, they are. I've spoken to people I spoke to a man in the Amazon who. We saw his young grandson just reduced to a skeleton.
It is a heartbreaking story. I mean, that's the story you broadcast, right? You did that story.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, it just absolutely broke my heart to think that boy was, and he was swimming not too far away from where the family always was.
But yeah, he just fell off the side of the floating hut.
Yeah,
but in other circumstances, you can just jump in the water where they are, and they're not interested. So again, it's all to do with understanding the behaviour of the fish. I mean, there's no way you could wipe out all the piranha in the Amazon because they're potentially dangerous to people. But again, it comes back to talking to the people. Whenever I go anywhere, I set great store by what the people say. And if they say it's okay to swim here, I'll generally believe them. And if they say it's not, I believe them.
I take their word for it.
Contact with the locals is very, very important.
Yeah, I take their word for it, too. So what's your favorite fish to eat?
Eating fish, complicated subject as well. I mean, sea fish are in a very bad way generally, and I don't normally eat river fish unless the stocks are sort of healthy. But there's one species of that Amazon fish, which is particularly delicious. We did a program earlier this year on a fish called a pacu, but there is a larger relative of that, a thing called a tambaki, and it's a very solid, slab-sided fish. And it eats, its diet is almost exclusively nuts that fall from trees. So when the Amazon floods, you have this incredible variation in water level there. Sometimes the water, it goes up annually by as much as 50 feet. And when the water goes up, this floods huge areas of forest. The fish come out of the river, they swim into the forest. And these tambaki, they will go and sit underneath rubber trees mainly, and they will just gorge on seeds falling in the water. They've got very, very powerful teeth. The teeth are almost like horse teeth, and they're designed for crushing these nuts. And so they're feeding on this very high protein, super organic diet. And in fact, for the rest of the year, they've gorged so much in the wet season, you catch them in the dry season, their stomachs are empty. It's real feast or famine. But the flesh is just incredible. The best way to eat them is you grill them slowly over embers, just sizzling in their own fat. And if it it's fresh, and you know, there's always a huge difference between fresh fish and something that's been transported or kept on ice. But fresh tambaki grilled is absolutely the best fish ever.
Very interesting. Nothing we're going to find at our neighborhood Red Lobster or anything like that. We're not going
to. They're not going to farm them. It's interesting. They're trying to farm them, but the trouble is, as soon as you farm them, they've got a different diet. You know, it's just not the same thing.
Not the same.
But yeah, that would be, that's my nomination.
And eels are very interesting to me because, and then we'll get to some phone calls coming up. We're talking with Jeremy Wade, but eels can grow huge, right? I mean, gigantic, and a lot of them are in fresh water. I would think that they would be considered amongst the most dangerous of the fish to encounter in a river.
Well, yeah, we were looking at eels in New Zealand, where they're said to grow, you know, 6, 7, 8 feet long, weigh over 100 pounds. I mean, along with most fish, you tend not to find them at the same sizes nowadays, but there are still some big ones around. And we showed them to be, you know, individually they're very muscular, but they will almost sort of feed in packs. I don't think there's a real sort of group mind thing, but if there's a piece of food or, you know, a dead animal or a struggling or weak animal, they'll tend to sort of home in on it. In one situation, I had about 30 eels, but if you added up the weight of the eels, there was more eel there than there was me in the water. But they're a very mysterious fish. I think that, you know, they're quite creepy, they're snake-like, and I think humans are sort of hardwired to feel afraid of anything that's snake-like. But this is,
yes,
this is snake-like. It lives in the water. They can grow very old, over 100 years. They come from the sea. They go back to the sea. The European and the American eels, nobody's ever seen them breeding in the wild. We think we know where it happens, but incredibly mysterious. Even in the 21st century, we don't fully understand the eel's life history. So sort of creepy, but also very mysterious and fascinating as well.
Are you running into the problem, as I was picking up as you were talking about the fourth season, of there aren't any more river monsters out there for you to find?
There is a finite number of species. We're starting to run into that problem. We're sort of revisiting some of the ones we've looked at already. There's new information coming to light. And one thing I am actually concerned about the program is that it can give a slightly false impression of the state of the world. If you watch one of our programs in isolation, it gives the impression that you've got these huge toothy fish in any body of fresh water, and it's going, you know, all you've got to do is dip your foot in a river or lake and something's going to, you know, bite it off. In fact, the number of fish that will do that, the number of species that will do that are quite rare. The number of individuals of those species are quite rare. And in fact, if you go to most rivers in the world, you know, you really actually do have to look for large fish. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it wouldn't have been like that. There has been a real decline in freshwater fish in recent decades. And one of the things I'm trying to do is just make people aware of these creatures that a lot of people didn't know existed. And it's interesting, although they are monsters, monsters is a word that means different things to different people, but you know, they're large, they're potentially dangerous. But it's interesting, a lot of people are starting to care about them. They are, as apex predators, they are very good indicators of the health of our rivers. And
right,
the fact that they're disappearing from lots of rivers is actually a sort of a wake-up call that rivers are in a bad way generally worldwide.
Well, we got to help out with that. And yet, whether you think of monsters just in terms of size, or the fact that it doesn't have a soul, which is how some people define a monster, a creature without a soul, you could sell me on a couple of those giant beings you pulled up out of the darkest rivers as being monsters on either definition. But we'll get back to your questions and comments for Jeremy Wade, River Monsters. Phones are already filling up. We'll get you up coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.